Thank you very much. So tonight we're going to be talking about what Milton did to the English language. And many books have been written on that subject, and you'll be pleased to hear our treatment won't be definitive. What I've done is to choose eight of my favourite bits of Milton. And I'll get Anton to read them and then talk about what seemed to me the prominent, salient linguistic features. We're extremely lucky to have Anton here. Naxos have brought out a complete reading of Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained on CD, which I have listened to with delight. He's a supremely sensitive and intelligent reader of these supremely great poems. Milton changed the language of English poetry. No poet had written English like him before, and for over 100 years afterwards, until the time of the Romantics, most English poets wrote Miltonic English, some of them very badly. Not that that's Milton's fault. Nearly all great writers have a disastrous following. Look at the terrible pseudo-poetry that T.S. Eliot spawned. I want to plunge straight in for my first choice at the apex of Milton's career and have Anton read the opening lines of his great epic poem, Paradise Lost.
Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe with loss of Eden. Till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat. Sing, heavenly muse, that on the secret top of Oreb or of Sinai didst inspire that shepherd who first taught the chosen seed in the beginning how the heavens and earth rose out of chaos. Or if Sion Hill delight thee more, and Siloa's brook that flowed fast by the oracle of God, I thence invoke thy aid to my adventurous song that with no middle flight intends to soar above the Aeonian mount, while it pursues things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme.
Now, the first thing you notice about that opening, I think, is the grammar and the word order, and that they aren't English, they're Latin. He's writing like Virgil, the great Roman epic poet, and deliberately so. Actually, you can translate those lines into Latin as they stand. Actually, I've done it. You start. De hominis, prima contumacia fructuque, and so on and so on. It's just turning into Latin words. Why does he do that? Because he wants to give his poem grandeur like Virgil's. He had a problem writing an epic poem about the subject matter of Paradise Lost. It's very hard to write an epic poem about two naked human beings wandering around a garden. So how do you do it? Well, he did three things. One, he introduced a war, a battle, the war in heaven, for which there's virtually no biblical evidence, one verse, one rather obscure verse. Two, he introduced a great epic hero, Satan. Again, not in very, very little about Satan in the Bible, and very little that makes him like Milton's Satan. And three, he changed the language. He made it a poem written in Latinate English, Virgilian English. Now, it's not just the syntax and the vocabulary that he changes for that purpose. He introduces various rhetorical devices, and prominent among those rhetorical devices, which we've just seen exemplified, is one which entails calling things and people by splendid roundabout names. the rhetorical name for it was antonomasia, or periphrastic naming. It was common in Virgil. So when he writes, "That shepherd who first taught the chosen seed in the beginning how the heavens and earth rose out of chaos," he means Moses. But if you said Moses, it wouldn't be like an epic poem. So you make it into 30 or 40 grand words. And that is what Milton learned, one of the things that Milton learned from Virgil. Now for my second piece, I want to go back to the early, in second and third indeed, back to the early Milton. We'll come back to Paradise Lost later. But the second one is from Lycidas, his elegy for a young fellow student at Cambridge, Edward King, who was drowned on the way to Ireland. The ship he was in went down. He was said to kneel on the, see, kneeling on the deck, was drowned. He wasn't actually a close friend of Milton's, perhaps hardly a friend at all, but a number of King's associates got together a book of poems to celebrate and memorialize him. And Milton contributed this amazing poem, the greatest English pastoral elegy. The fact that it was a pastoral elegy very much annoyed some critics. Dr. Johnson said, "It is a pastoral, easy, vulgar, and therefore disgusting." And he didn't like it because he said it was all fiction. All these pagan gods and goddesses. No one believes in them. Milton doesn't believe in them. No one does. He says, where there is leisure for fiction, there is little grief. Where there is leisure for fiction, there is little grief. It's quite a wise Johnsonian comment. And indeed, he's right, I think, about Lycidas. It is play. It's wonderful play. He plays at believing, and almost perhaps does believe in these pagan things. And at the end of the poem, and this is the bit I'm going to get Anton to read, at the end of the poem, playfully, perhaps, he pretends he has not written it. He pretends he's heard it. He was listening, and he heard a strange, semi-supernatural figure singing it. He calls him the uncouth swain, meaning unknown. Uncouth meant unknown in the 17th century. Doesn't know who this singer was. So Anton will read the last lines of the poem where Milton denies his authorship.
"Thus sang the uncouth swain to the oaks and rills, while the still morn went out with sandals grey. He touched the tender stops of various quills, with eager thought warbling his Doric lay. And now the sun had stretched out all the hills, now was dropped into the western bay. At last he rose and twitched his mantle blue. Tomorrow to fresh woods and pastures new."
You'll see that that figure sings not to a human audience, but to oaks and rills. And the figure that's evoked by Milton deliberately there is Orpheus, the mythical singer whose song would draw rocks and trees and quietened the gods of hell. You may went down to hell and brought back Eurydice almost, but looked back and she disappeared. Milton was obsessed by Orpheus in the early poetry. Young Milton obsessed by Orpheus. And here is Orpheus in disguise as an uncouth swain. And he's a poet who enlivens things. He has the power to enliven things. That's what I think Milton was so entranced by. And the line I love here is, "He touched the tender stops of various quills." So he's saying he's playing on a pan pipes. He doesn't say pipes. He says quills. And quills are something, of course, a bird has, bird's feathers. And then the word tender, the tender stops, as if they feel him touching them, as if he's playing almost on a live bird or a bird that's coming alive as he sings. The tender stops of various quills. This is Orpheus, magic Orpheus, enlivening things. And notice too that, very strangely, he takes all day singing. He starts, while the still morn went out with sandals grey. Then at the end, now the sun had stretched out all the hills, now was dropped into the western bay. All day, but it's only a 200-line poem. In other words, he sings in a time that is not ours, as well as to oaks and rills and things that we don't believe can hear. Lycidas then, and then for my third piece, I'd like to go back even further to 1634. Lycidas was 1637. Milton born, you remember, in 1608. 1634, Milton wrote a masque called Comus for a very grand family, the Bridgewater family. The Earl of Bridgewater had been made Lord Lieutenant of the Council of Wales, and he was to be installed at Ludlow Castle. And this masque was performed on Michaelmas night at Ludlow Castle in 1634. Now, Milton didn't know these very grand people at all. I'd almost certainly never met them. The man he knew was Henry Lawes, who the musician, who was the Egerton children's music teacher and a friend of Milton's father. And it's pretty clear that Lawes got Milton the commission to write this masque. And the masque is about the three Egerton children, Alice, Lady Alice, who is 15, and John and Thomas, who are 11 and 9. And they're going through a wood to get to their parents' castle, Ludlow Castle. And the little boys get separated from Alice. They go off looking for berries and can't find her. So she's wandering alone in the wood. And in the wood is an evil enchanter, a supernatural being, a sort of anti-Orpheus, who is followed by a mob of monsters, men with animal heads. And Alice, wandering in the wood, hears the noise this rout of Comus makes, and is frightened, is terrified, and speaks her terror. And this is the bit that, the next bit that Anton will read.
O thievish knight, why shouldst thou, but for some felonious end, in thy dark lantern thus close up the stars that nature hung in heaven and filled their lamps with everlasting oil to give due light to the misled and lonely traveller? This is the place, as well as I may guess, whence even now the tumult of loud mirth was rife and perfect in my listening ear, yet naught but single darkness do I find. What might this be? A thousand fantasies begin to throng into my memory of calling shapes and beckoning shadows dire and airy tongues that syllable men's names on sands and shores and desert wildernesses.
Well, we've talked about Virgil's influence, but here is another voice. Here in the earlier Milton is another voice. O thievish knight, why shouldst thou but felonious end in thy dark lantern thus close up the stars? It's Shakespeare, isn't it? From Macbeth. Come, sealing night, scarf up the tender eye of pitiful day. And Banquo also in Macbeth. There's husbandry in heaven. Their candles are all out. It's Shakespeare. Milton learned from, as a young man, learned from Shakespeare enormously and admired him greatly. He was one of the first to recognize Shakespeare's genius. In 1630, he wrote a sonnet to Shakespeare. What needs my Shakespeare for his honored bones, the labor of an age in pallid stones? My Shakespeare. And it was published, that sonnet, in the 1632 second folio of Shakespeare. Amazing. He was hardly known. And there it is. And he reprints it in his 1645 poems. So Shakespeare's enormous influence. People think of him as quite a different poet from Shakespeare. Yes, he is, but he learns from Shakespeare an enormous amount. And one thing he learns is how to use words in a new way or make new words. And here we have it in this speech that Anton read. Airy tongues that syllable men's names. No one had used syllable as a verb before. And it is very strange, eerie and weird as it's meant to be. Syllable. Like a Dalek speaking, I always think. And that hissing which Anton brought out to him, wildernesses, as the girl fantasizes about these evil things, something sinister comes into her mind, and he gets it in the word, in that use of the word syllable. There's fairly recent research is found from the Oxford English Dictionary that though Shakespeare used to be thought to be the writer who had coined most new words in the English language, actually Milton is. Milton has 630. Johnson, Ben Johnson, 558. Shakespeare, 229. Of course, it's not the number, but how you use them that matters. But several of Milton's are very common words. Padlock, terrific, fragrance, dismissive, and so on. And syllable used in that way as a verb. A lot of his coinages are nouns to verbs or verbs to nouns. So for my fourth piece, I'd like to go back to Paradise Lost. Now we've looked at antonomasia or periphrastic naming, that shepherd and so on that first taught the chosen seed. Now I'd like to look at another way of getting grandeur into Paradise Lost. This is a great problem, to get grandeur in. And it is exemplified by this fourth piece, which is the description of the Garden of Eden in Paradise Lost.
Not that fair field of Enna, where Proserpine, gathering flowers, herself a fairer flower, by gloomy Dis was gathered, which cost Ceres all that pain to seek her through the world. Nor that sweet grove of Daphne by Orontes, the inspired Castalian spring, might with this paradise of Eden strive. Nor that Nicaean isle, girt with the river Triton, where old Cham, whom Gentiles Ammon call, and Libyan Jove, hid Amalthea and her florid son, young Bacchus, from his stepdame Rhea's eye, nor where Abassin kings their issue guard, Mount Amara. Though this by some supposed true paradise under the Ethiop line by Nilus' head, enclosed with shining rock, a whole day's journey high, but wide remote from this Assyrian garden, where the fiend saw, undelighted, all delight, all kind of living creatures, new to sight and strange.
You'll see that what Milton does there is to gather a wonderful treasury of exotic mythological names and stories. Proserpina snatched by Dis, king of the underworld, and the grove by the river Orontes where the nymph Daphne was turned into a laurel to save her from the pursuing Apollo. And the Isle of Nyssa near Tunis, where Ammon, king of Libya, also identified with Jupiter, Libyan Jove, Milton calls him, and Noah, the son of Noah, old Cham, he calls him, hid Bacchus, his love child, from his father's eye, Amalthea's florid son. And Mount Amara, enclosed with shining rock a whole day's journey high, which had a garden on the top where the emperor of Abyssinia was said to keep his sons locked up to avoid sedition. And what have all these stories and names and marvels got to do with Eden? Nothing at all. Not that fair field of Enna, nor that sweet grove could compare with Eden. It's all wide remote from this. So here's another way he enriches the language of Paradise Lost, gives it grandeur, besides antonomasia. He fills it with marvelous noises. It's the noisiest poem in the language. Sonorous clashing names and places and people. And he shamelessly hauls these treasures in and then says, of course, that's nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with the subject of Paradise Lost at all. There's another wonderful, magnificent example of that same technique, which is my next piece, number 5. It's in book 1, and it's in the description of pandemonium. The devils in hell build a palace called pandemonium, another word that Milton invented for the language. And this next piece is about the architect who built it and the myths that surround him.
The hasty multitude, admiring, entered. And the work, some praise, and some, the architect. His hand was known in heaven by many a towered structure high, where sceptred angels held their residence and sat as princes, whom the supreme king exalted to such power and gave to rule, each in his hierarchy, the orders bright. Nor was his name unheard or unadored in ancient Greece. And in Ausonian land, men called him Mulciber. And how he fell from heaven, they fabled, thrown by angry Jove sheer o'er the crystal battlements. From morn to noon, he fell from noon to dewy eve, a summer's day, and with the setting sun dropped from the zenith, like a falling star on Lemnos, the Aegean Isle. Thus they relate, erring.
Erring is all quite wrong, just a pagan myth. But what a myth, and how he tells it, how he uses the language. Particularly I love that day-long fall, and how he slows it up by repetition. There is, as it were, a long way away, Mulciber thrown over the crystal battlements, and he seems to fall very slowly, thrown by angry Jove, sheer over the crystal battlements. From morn to noon he fell, from noon to dewy eve, nothing slower to fall than dew, a summer's day. And with the setting sun, another very slow falling thing. With the setting sun, and then I imagine how I see it. You see him falling very far away, very slowly as things seem to fall, though they're going fast. But as he comes closer to the earth, he speeds up. It gets nearer to you and you see, so he's dropped from the zenith, suddenly gets quick as he is about to hit the Isle of Lemnos. And the technique, I may be fanciful, but there's a thing in classical poetry and in English poetry called elision. Probably know. If a word ends in a vowel and the next word starts in a vowel, you can elide. In classical poetry, it's important because you've got very strict scansion. You can elide and cram them together. And actually, Milton does that here. What he writes is th apostrophe aegean on Lemnos, Thagean Isle, as if, you know, Mulciber was squashed as he hits the earth. A syllable's gone. A marvelous piece of what of you have to call imitative syntax. It's used throughout Paradise Lost. Wonderful imitative syntax. As if you're watching a film. He's trying and trying to get it into your visual and also your oral imagination. And then the sixth of my choices. Now this is from the climax of Paradise Lost. This is the most important moment in human history. Fall of man. If it hadn't happened, none of us would die or have to work. Very important. And what happens? Well, it's in book 9. And Eve is approached by Satan. Eve, as you've read the poem, Eve is unfortunately intelligent, fairly intelligent. Intelligent enough to argue with Adam about whether she should go gardening alone. It may seem a trivial question, it's vital. She says, why shouldn't we go gardening alone? We're supposed to be responsible grown-ups. Adam says, Adam dare not say, because if you go, you're less safe than you were with me. That's what he should say, of course. But he daren't. He explains to Raphael. Raphael is a visiting angel who comes to warn Adam at some length before the fall. And he warns him. Adam says to him that he's quite worried. Adam says he's quite worried. Of course, when he's near Eve, he finds he can't think properly. He says, everything she says seems to be true. Wisdom, in discourse with her, it suddenly seems like folly. Raphael understands and says, this is very bad. This is very bad. This isn't love, this is passion. And passion is wrong. In loving, thou dost well. In passion, not. Wherein true love resides not. Love is like reason, says Raphael. Well, he's an angel, but that's what he thinks. So Adam has plenty of warning. And so has Eve. But she meets this talking snake. She meets the talking snake and she tells Adam later how interested she was. It could talk. And how she'd often wondered why animals couldn't talk. It was talking. It was very nice. And it offered her the apple. And said indeed how wonderful the apple was. This is Satan's most brilliant idea. How wonderful the apple was, because that's why he can talk. He just had a chew of this apple, and he can talk. So if he can talk, what would it do to you, Eve? You know, make you better than Adam, is what she thinks. Yep. It's a very lifelike story. And so, she comes back through the trees, holding the fruit, and she tells Adam about the talking snake and how she'd eaten the fruit. Now, of course, remember, the fruit, so far as they know, is poisonous. In the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. In the day. So Adam is aghast. And what Anton is going to read is Milton's description of his thoughts. Not what he says, you notice. This is an internal soliloquy. What he thinks immediately.
On the other side, Adam, soon as he heard the fatal trespass done by Eve, amazed, astonished, stood and blank, while horror chill ran through his veins and all his joints relaxed. From his slack hand the garland wreathed for Eve down dropped, and all the faded roses shed. Speechless he stood, and pale, till thus at length, first to himself, he inward silence broke. O fairest of creation, last and best of all God's works, creature in whom excelled whatever can to sight or thought be formed, holy, divine, good, amiable, or sweet, how art thou lost? How, on a sudden, lost, defaced, deflowered, and now to death devote? Rather, How hast thou yielded to transgress the strict forbiddance? How to violate the sacred fruit forbidden? Some cursed fraud of enemy hath beguiled thee, yet unknown, and me with thee hath ruined. For with thee certain my resolution is to die. How can I live without thee? How forego thy sweet converse and love so dearly joined to live again in these wild woods forlorn? Should God create another Eve, and I another rib afford, yet loss of thee would never from my heart. No, no. I feel the link of nature draw me, flesh of flesh, bone of my bone thou art. And from thy state mine never shall be parted, bliss or woe.
Of course, we see there how like Shakespeare he is, Milton is. That could be the speech of a Shakespearean tragic hero. And we all agree, I suppose, that's what he should have said and does say. He'll die with her. And yet, that is the great sin that lost us all, the fall of man. How brilliantly Milton has contrived it, that we agree he did right to fall. Of course, it raises the question, what should he have done? Which critics have endlessly debated, some of the harsher ones, and they may be right, say he should have divorced Eve on the spot. He wrote divorce pamphlets, Milton. He thought he supported divorce, much against the ethos of the time, was greatly attacked for it. Well, here would be an opportunity to divorce Eve, but can you imagine him doing it? What should he have done? I think perhaps Milton's our answer would have been he should have gone and begged for forgiveness for Eve. Beg God's forgiveness. For in fact, that's what they do afterwards. When he has fallen, they make love, they feel drunk, they lose their temper with each other. And Eve is much the wiser. Because she says to Adam, we should go and beg forgiveness from God. And he says, no, nonsense. God doesn't change his decrees. But actually they do. When God walks in the garden, they beg forgiveness and, of course, receive forgiveness. At least what is called forgiveness in this Christian doctrine, which means that their death doesn't happen immediately, but they have time to have lots of children who die too. I mean, it's not... I think Milton himself felt that was a curious kind of forgiveness. But perhaps that is what he should have done, that he should have gone and begged for forgiveness. You'll see, though, that already, I mean, when he says, live again in these wild woods forlorn, this Garden of Eden is not wild woods, but he's imagining it already without Eve. Could God create another Eve and I another rib afford, yet thought of thee would never from my heart. So, if this is the fall of man, if it's the great sin, yet we all agree with what he does, where does he go wrong? What is wrong? I ask that question because it draws attention to something else in Milton's language. I've talked so far rather about, well, the noises he makes, the grandeur that he puts into the poem by various rhetorical devices and Latinate usages. But it isn't just noise. Tis a wonderful noise, Paradise Lost, unparalleled. It's not just noise. The words are used with enormous care. And actually, Anton's reading brought out beautifully the key words in this. When Adam says, holy, divine, good, amiable, and sweet of Eve. Holy, divine, no, she is not. This is blasphemy. We listen because we're lured by love poetry and and the sacrifice he's making. And we miss the point of those words. But Milton doesn't miss it. And this is exactly what Raphael warned him against, thinking that Eve was the best of creation, that she was more important than him, that he should prize her above God, holy and divine. These are words of sin in Milton and in Christian thinking. And they're hidden. They're like booby traps. You miss them until you go back. You need to read Paradise Lost again and again. And indeed, of course, critics do. And the more they go, the more intelligent they find it to be. The more meaning is hidden under its sonority. So, I want to move on for the next choice to a work that he wrote after Paradise Lost. He's not quite certain when, but after the Restoration, after 1660, he's pretty certain. Samson Agonistes, a drama based on the Samson story. I find this drama particularly interesting in the present political climate for this reason. You remember the Samson story. Samson is lured by Dalila to tell where his strength lies, in his hair. And so she shears off his hair. He's weak. He's captured by the Philistines. He is set to labor in the mill at Gaza. And a way is given to him of redeeming, so to speak, the situation. The Philistines take him, this blind giant, to perform in their games. And it's in a arena where the tiers of seats are on two huge pillars, which supports the whole building. And this architecture is known to Samson. Of course, he's been in Gaza before. He asks the boy who is leading him to put his hands on the pillars, and he destroys the temple and himself. Now, in the Bible account, there are interesting divergences from what Milton makes of the story. And to me, the most interesting is this. In the Bible account, Samson prays to God when he is standing there with his hands on the pillars and says, "Strengthen me, O Lord, this once, that I may be avenged on the Philistines for the loss of my eyes, and let me die with the Philistines." Now, since he then does indeed pull down building, it's clear that the Lord, that God answers his prayer, gives him strength. So, you might say, if you were a modern reader, God, the Almighty, Jehovah, is implicated in genocide, racial genocide, the slaughter of the Philistines. Milton omits that prayer. Milton says, of course, it's reported afterwards by a messenger, that what happened was that Samson bowed his head as one who prayed, or some great matter in his mind revolved. Perhaps he prayed, perhaps not. You don't hear it, it's not there. In other words, it seems to me that Milton questions the notion of genocidal killing which has divine authority behind it. Pretty important matter in our world. Milton, rewriting the story, questions it. He's an amazingly daring writer, Milton. Amazing. In Paradise Lost, he, as you heard Anton read, invokes Urania, the heavenly muse, and he invokes her because, as we heard, she inspired Moses, who wrote the Mosaic books, Genesis and so on, in the Bible. Milton presents Paradise Lost, there's no question, as by, so to speak, the author of Genesis, by the Spirit who inspired Moses. It is not fiction. It is a continuation of the Bible. He presents Paradise Regained in exactly the same way. These things really happened, he says. And in Paradise Regained, he says they were worthy to have not remained so long unsung. No one has actually known what happened before. He's writing an appendix to the Bible. You might say, he must be mad, you'd say. Well, you remember it's the mid-17th century, the age of the ranters, of visions, of millenarians. We might say it's mad now, but there's no doubt that's what Milton thought. He didn't think he was writing fiction. Milton only wrote Paradise Lost in his sleep. He wrote it in his sleep. Various people, he says it himself in the poem, and various people corroborate this who knew him. And then he would dictate the poem when he woke up in sections of 10 or 20 lines, and the amanuensis would take it down. He said he'd wait to be milked in the morning after his sleep. These pieces of the Bible. So changing Samson Agonistes' Samson's story in that way is not chance. This is the new Bible for Milton. He's an extraordinary, revolutionary figure, of course. Not just a matter of being a regicide, and which is why Johnson hated him, of course, killing Charles I. It's something much more than that. It's rewriting Christianity in his own version. He wrote a work called Christian Doctrine, a Latin work, which I've translated, which is amazing. I mean, the complete heresy. He couldn't possibly have published it. It was never published in the 17th century. And so it's not surprising when you think of that, that these poems are so unorthodox. Well, the bit I've chosen from Samson Agonistes is about blindness. In 1652, Milton went blind. He had been going blind for some years. There's a letter he wrote to a Swiss physician describing his symptoms. Very, very moving. Rather like, actually, curiously like hell, he says, is a flashes of light and an ashiness, like the hell that the devil's falling to in Paradise Lost. Anyway, here, Anthony's going to read Samson's description of his own blindness, which I suppose you might say is perhaps Milton lamenting his.
Light, the prime work of God, to me is extinct. And all her various objects of delight annulled, which might in part my grief have eased. Inferior to the vilest now become of man or worm, the vilest here excel me. They creep, yet see, I, dark in light, exposed to daily fraud, contempt, abuse and wrong, within doors or without, still as a fool in power of others, never in my own. Scarce half I seem to live, dead more than half. Oh, dark, 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 amid the blaze of noon, irrecoverably dark, total eclipse, without all hope of day. Oh, first created beam, and thou great word, let there be light, and light was over all. Why am I thus bereaved thy prime decree? The sun to me is dark, and silent as the moon when she deserts the night, hid in her vacant interlunar cave. Since light so necessary is to life, and almost life itself, if it be true that light is in the soul, she all in every part, why was the sight to such a tender ball as the eye confined, so obvious and so easy to be quenched, and not as feeling through all parts, diffused.
You can't miss the agony, of course, in those lines. And how the language is used to convey it. The sun to me is dark and silent as the moon. Milton transfers the sense he has lost, sight, to the sense he still has, hearing. Nothing could be more silent than the sun or the moon. Imagine that they should be as void of light as they are of sound. Imagine what it's like straining to hear the moon or the sun. That's what it's like, we gather, straining to see if you're going blind. The sun to me is dark and silent as the moon. And the other bit after that, hid the moon, when she deserts the night, hid in her vacant interlunar cave. Surreal. I mean, his poetry is, it seems to me, surreal in its figurativeness. The moon hiding in a vacant, that is, empty cave. How can it be vacant if she's hiding in it? What is an interlunar cave? Marvelous words. But beyond imagining, mysterious and empty. And the last of the eight pieces I would like Anton to read is from Paradise Regained. Paradise Regained is probably his last work. It used to be thought that Samson was later, but it's probably not, I think. And Paradise Regained is very, very different from Paradise Lost. It's about the temptation in the wilderness. Jesus Christ meets in disguise, though he penetrates the disguise, Satan in the wilderness. And the temptations are not quite the same as in the Bible. They're more temptations. What is extraordinarily telling about that poem, I think, is that it is so intelligent. Christ is simply intelligent. He doesn't lift a finger. He's taken up to the pinnacle and shown the kingdom of the earth and so on. He's completely passive, but he outwits all Satan's arguments. Turns them around, Satan gets more and more furious. His pure intelligence and, I think it's important, pure faith. He is absolutely convinced that whatever he needs to know, God will supply him with, will tell him. It's not clear that he has any memory of his own divinity, that he is the Son of God back in heaven, so not at all. He just has absolute faith. And so on the pinnacle, when Satan says, cast yourself down, he just quotes the Bible. It says, also is written, tempt not the Lord thy God. And Satan, in Milton, though not in the Bible, falls off. Satan, smitten with amazement, fell. So astounded. He's come up against this completely nerveless man. Very intelligent, no nerves, just stands there. And that's why I think, what Adam should have done was go and ask forgiveness. He should have had that complete faith in God that Christ has got, second Adam has got in Paradise Regained. Complete faith in God would have meant that he wouldn't possibly think, live again in these wild woods forlorn and so on, and God taking Eve away. He would trust God and would ask for forgiveness. That's what he should have done. And it's exemplified by Christ in Paradise Regained. And the bit that I have chosen is, I think, the most moving, in a way, bit. Satan's very different from the Satan of Paradise Lost, of course. He's got more used to being a fallen angel. He's much more cunning and also cleverer at temptations. And one thing he tempts Jesus Christ to be is merciful. And the bit that Anton is going to read is where he does that. He is told by Jesus that when he, Jesus, comes to power and achieves his everlasting kingdom, that will mean Satan's destruction. This is what Satan replies.
To whom the tempter, inly racked, replied, let that come when it comes. All hope is lost of my reception into grace. What worse? For where no hope is left no fear. If there be worse, the expectation more of worse torments me than the feeling can. I would be at the worst. Worst is my port, my harbour, and my ultimate repose, the end I would attain, my final good. My error was my error, my crime, my crime. Whatever for itself condemned and will alike be punished, whether thou reign or reign not. though to that gentle brow willingly I could fly, and hope thy reign from that placid aspect and meek regard, rather than aggravate my evil state, would stand between me and thy father's ire, whose ire I dread more than the fire of hell, a shelter and a kind of shading, cool interposition as a summer's cloud.
You'll see, it's not like the language of Paradise Lost at all. There are no magnificent proper names and no mythological splendor. It's plain and it's idiomatic. It's nearer to Shakespeare, very near to Shakespeare. Worst is my port, my harbor, my ultimate repose. King Lear saying, who is it can say I'm at the worst? And in Othello, here is my butt and very sea mark of my utmost sail. Those images from Shakespeare are there. And then a shelter and a kind of shading, cool interposition as a summer's cloud. That's in Macbeth, the play that was in his mind when the lady speaking in Comus. Macbeth, can such things be and overcome us like a summer's cloud without our special wonder? Notice how beautifully Anton brought it out, the imitative syntax that shapes and arranges the words to imitate the sense. An interposition, it's a very slow cloud going across the sun, interposition, like a summer's cloud, the only five-syllable word in the piece. So, now you should go away and listen to Anton reading the rest of Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained on CDs, and it will tell you much more about Milton's poetry than any amount of critical commentary will do. Thank you.